Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. Today I'm joined in the studio by writer Mark Mason for this week's literary discussion. From past shows we know that Mark has a thirst for trivia, so we'll be mulling over two non-fiction reads that lift the lid on the weirder workings of a policeman and delve into the social history of the humble public park. And before all that, we'll discuss the second book in Paul Kingsnorth's Buckmaster trilogy, Beast. All that to come right here on the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. Stay tuned. As promised, we'll begin today with Beast, the second book in Paul Kingsnorth's Buckmaster trilogy, following the much-acclaimed first story, The Wake. Mark, welcome to the show. A lot of people might not have heard of this trilogy. The first book wasn't a bestseller, but it did get a lot of nominations for prestigious prizes. Fill us in a little bit on what it's about and where we left off at the end of the last book.
Well, this one is, it's one of those books where you say, what's it about? It's not about much. Not an awful lot happened. It's one of those novels, if you like your James Patterson or your John Grisham, I wouldn't go for this. It's not, it's a, what they call literary rather than commercial, which I've always thought as from inside publishing, basically literary means isn't expected to sell very many, which I've always thought is quite, you know, hard on the author. But of course the dream is there's a literary novel that sells a lot, like The Life of Pi or something like that. That's, and you get the best of both worlds. You get the kudos and you get the sales. But this is, like I say, it's about a, not an awful lot happens. It's about a guy who is, we don't even learn his name for the first 37 pages. It turns out he's called Edward Buckmaster. And he's down in the West Country somewhere, Dartmoor or somewhere like that, down in the west of Britain. And for a long time, we don't know why he's gone down there. We sense that he's a very troubled soul. It's told in the first person. It's all, you know, I did this and I did that. And so we're inside his head. And a lot of it happens inside his head. And we gradually learn, and even this is only hinted at very briefly, that he's gone down there to escape his partner and his very young daughter. And he's run away and his partner's not very happy about it. And he's a troubled soul. And Beast, the title, gives the clue. It's all about the sort of wildness of the terrain and the wildness inside his head. It's one of those where the quote early on that he gives is, on the high moor there are patterns, and in my small mind there are patterns. So it's one of those novels inside the head. And the beast of the title is, he goes out for a walk and sort of sees this mysterious beast in the distance, isn't quite sure, sees it out the corner of his eye, and then gets obsessed with it. So it's one of those, it's quite difficult to talk about. I very stupidly decided to review this. But I did like it because it's a sort of mood novel. And if you, the theme it does throw up is, how much are we humans and how much are we animals?
Interesting. I mean, are we led to believe that this beast is a metaphorical beast, that there's not actually, you know, an animal out there, that this is more something inside his head?
You could, for a long time, you could believe that. Actually, it's not. I mean, it does turn out it is there. But yeah, it's got that feel to it. It's playing with your head a lot of the time. And like I say, the theme is, how much have we imposed civilization on the planet? And he's obviously gone there because he's sick of civilization and he wants to get back to something very natural.
Interesting. The first book was written in a kind of invented form of Old English. Does the second book follow that, or are we safely in modern English territory?
We're safely. I've set this up as a hard read. It's not. I did enjoy it. But it's, no, you're safely in modern English. And they plays with the sentence structure sometimes, and some of it's without punctuation. But you can tell what he's thinking. I think it's the theme that I found interesting, is he's gone there and he's very, and he does waver from this somewhat. But at the beginning, it's all about, yeah, I want to get back to civilization. If I can get back to our absolute animal core, then I'll be able to discover something about myself. But then at one point he injures himself and he's very glad of the painkillers and the medicine that can help him with that. So, and it, I'm sort of, I was against, I think in the end I'd come down against his argument there that we need to get back to civilization. Because civilization,
so we need to get away from civilization.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. Right. And I would argue against that. I would say my gut feeling about it is that civilization is only there because once we were animals and we got bored with it.
Right.
Once we'd gone out of the cave and we'd set up, you know, we discovered how to cook. That's one of the big things in evolutionary theory, is that once we discovered how to cook meat, we didn't have to waste all our body's energy by digesting it raw. Some of that, you know, that then gave us lots of energy to divert our brain power to something else, and that's how we started tools and then buildings. And so I think it's, I know why, I can understand why people who are sick of the city want to get out of it and get back to nature. But actually, those cities are only there because they were built by humans. And, you know, we are still animals, but we've progressed from that.
Beast by Paul Kingsnorth comes out on the 7th of July, published by Faber and Faber. Mark, we're going to move on now to your second book, A Walk in the Park, The Life and Times of a People's Institution by Travis Elborough. It's a celebration of something we, particularly in the UK, often take for granted, public parks. What was it about this that you liked the most, Mark?
The history, it's one of those straight histories of the institution, the park, and there's lots of interesting information in there, and you see how it's developed. And Travis Elborough's got a sort of argument that runs through it, which is that we only really needed parks in this country. And in, you know, any industrialised country, once the Industrial Revolution came along, and cities built up, and then people, again, it goes back to, I hadn't really spotted that until I'm in the middle of this sentence, it goes back to the first book. It's that nature versus the city debate. And so the 19th century in Britain was when, at the beginning of that century, 20% of people lived in cities, and at the end of it, 20% of people lived in the country. That was the time, that was the century where everyone went to live, or almost everyone went to live in the city. And so we needed parks. But the stuff from before that, that, of course, you know, back in centuries past, the countryside was our park. We had the whole country. But then rich people and monarchs in particular came along and started cordoning off bits of the country. For instance, one of the first parks, or one of the first instances of that happening, was 1129. Henry I had 7 miles of wall put around Woodstock in Oxfordshire so that he could, not just to keep the poor people out and reserve it for his own use, but so that he could enclose his animals there. And remember, this is the 12th century. Lions, leopards, camels, and also England's first porcupine.
Amazing.
So it's one of those books where that sort of weird little detail is constantly coming at you.
When did they become public parks, though? Because obviously, yeah, that was a king's, very much a private park, I assume. When did they become a public institution?
Well, like I said, I mean, the 19th century is the big expansion.
Right.
But even then, the Regent's Park in London was kept, it was made as a park, set up as a park, but then it was kept closed to the public for ages because they might damage the trees. So eventually, you know, it's a very socialist thing. And also at the end of the book, Travis Elborough says that, you know, now more and more parks, public parks, their facilities are being farmed out to private companies and their facilities are being charged for, and there's a big private enterprise element coming back.
Does he have a kind of a strong opinion on that? Is that basically where the book gets to? You know, we've had the celebration, and now we have to kind of protect them.
Is there a call for arms? There's some of that. It's not a militant book in any sense, but yeah, that argument is there. But then there's also the little quirky, weird historical stuff, like opening of Birkenhead Park, which is a very unglamorous area near up in the northwest near Liverpool. And that in 1847 it opened with a slow donkey race. So the last donkey won, in quotes, no carrots allowed. But what I also love about Birkenhead Park is that Frederick Law Olmsted came over from America, and that's what inspired him to set up Central Park in New York.
Amazing.
And so it's incredible that this very untrendy area of Britain gave rise to probably the world's most famous park, Central Park. But then there's also this weird thing of, If something bad happens in a park, it's like something bad happening in nature, and it's particularly bad. And Travis Elborough gives the example of 1973. There were 3 murders in Central Park in that year. There were 1,676 murders in the rest of the city, but in Central, those 3 murders in Central Park got all the attention because it's happening in this weird, in this lovely, iconic, urban, pastoral, beautiful landscape. So they stand out much more than the rest of the urbanised part of the city. And so this weird sort of schizophrenic split in us between nature and city.
How interesting. I mean, you've mentioned a couple of kind of trivia bits there, and it does seem there's bits of it that are quite whimsical. I mean, do you think that for a budding urbanist, would there be something here that they could potentially learn and then put to use in their job? I mean, is it instructional in that way?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And also the difference. Yeah, they teach you a lot about the nature of parks around the country. One of the things that Elborough keeps coming back to is the English have always liked parks where nature. There's a quote actually, Joseph Addison in The Spectator from the early 1700s, 1712, he said, the English prefer parks where nature can take its own course to overly topiaried, trees. That's quite a difficult word to say, only it's overly topiarid.
I'm very impressed.
I know. I've done it twice now. I'm not going to risk it by going for the hat trick. Overly, that word, trees and bushes of French parks. So comparing the
kind of manicured,
fancy,
yeah.
So the famous ones in Paris where all the hedges are cut into shapes and things. And the British have always, they've needed the park in the city, but they've always liked it to be a bit wild and to sort of hark back to the countryside of centuries past.
A Walk in the Park, The Life and Times of a People's Institution by Travis Elborough is out now, published by Jonathan Cape. We recommend a sunny, grassy spot to read that one in. Our final book today is Why Did the Policeman Cross the Road? How to Solve Problems Before They Arise, by former Scotland Yard Criminal Intelligence Officer Stephen Colgan. This looks at the imaginative ways in which ex-copper Colgan tried to prevent crime during his 30 years on the police force. Mark, what sorts of things are we talking about here? What kind of solutions is he offering up?
Very clever ones and not the obvious ones. And that's why the department was set up in the first place, the problem-solving unit. It's aiming to stop crimes before they even happen. So prevention rather than cure, to use the phrase from medicine. And, you know, there's the old ways of policing are very obvious, and you just go and arrest them and punish them, and that's the way the system worked. But what I loved about this was that it was, I suppose the cliched phrase is sideways thinking, or taking a sideways look at the problem. Solutions like painting your heavy machinery, like diggers and lorries and really heavy industrial plant and machinery, if you paint it pink, that will stop it being stolen because it makes it stand out. Thieves avoid things like that because they're going to be hard to sell on. And so that was one of the tips they gave. And also things like clubbers coming out of clubs in the middle of town, certainly in residential areas, coming out 3, 4, 5 in the morning, making a lot of noise. They're all high on whatever they've been high on and they're still having a good time. And so, of course, the residents complain, what can you do? You can go in the very heavy-handed, old-fashioned way and just tell them to shut up and arrest them. Or one of their ideas that they tried, and it worked, was to give the clubbers lollipops. So they put this, as they're walking away, they start sucking on their lollipops. They're not going to start chatting. They're not going to make a noise and disturb people. So it's almost like a detective novel, this, in putting a twist on something and a quirky solution to something. It's fascinating.
And does it give the impression that the police force, at least in this country, is capable of change? I mean, is there hope that this, you know, these solutions could be adopted on a wide scale, or is it more kind of a sense of despair that it's never going to happen?
There is a bit of that in there, and, you know, coming up against the old-fashioned, you know, view of just arrest them and come down on them hard. But actually, it's sometimes it can be a very easy solution that has an effect. And I liked the way that Colgan compares the different countries around the world that have tried this sort of thing. For instance, in Italy, the way they deal with dangerous driving or with driving offences. In Britain, the way it works is you start off with 0 points on your licence, and if you do an offence that gives you 3, 6 points, whatever, once you get up to 12 points, then you're disqualified for a while. In Italy, they've got essentially the same system, but all they do is you start off with 12 points and then they take points away. And if you get down to zero, that's when you're disqualified. So it's that psychological thing of, if you've got 12 points, you really value them and you don't want to lose them. And that makes you more inclined to pay attention to what you're doing. So it's really clever, subtle stuff like that. It doesn't cost any money. It's not about, you know, using lots of public money to do this sort of thing. It's just taking a little while and trying a twist on something, and then it can work.
How interesting. I guess, I mean, does he talk about kind of recidivism, people, you know, going to prisons and, because this is something that's been in the news recently quite a lot in the UK. We're looking at prison reforms here. Does he talk about, you know, trying to stop that from happening, where people go to prison and effectively end up coming out and reoffending?
Yeah, there's a bit of that, but mainly it's about stopping them being criminals in the first place and stopping the problem before it happens. It's a book where it's about stopping crimes rather than stopping people going back to crimes when they've already started. It's about stopping them getting into that position in the first place. A lot of it to do with kids. There's one story that Colgan tells that he was involved in personally in London. There was an underpass, a subway under a road, that it was one of those subways where kids started hanging around in it and being quite intimidating. And so pensioners who used to use it to walk through to go shopping were being intimidated and were stopping using it. And so Colgan's solution was to say to the pensioners, all right, we'll accompany you teachers accompanying crocodiles of kids walking through a public area. The police would accompany the pensioners and and walk them past the kids and to protect them. But that was what Colgan told the pensioners. The reason he was actually doing it was that they would deliberately stop when they got near the kids in the underpass and start the pensioners talking to the kids. And there were things like pensioners would say, "Here, you're Gladys's grandson, aren't you?" They'd recognize, of course, they're all local, so they recognize each other. And the pensioners gradually realized that the kids were hanging around there because they were bored. They weren't actually violent, but if it had been allowed to carry on in the original situation, the kids could have felt alienated. That's when they could have become a problem.
Right. So but on either side, there was kind of this build-up of
emotion. It's a very political thing, yeah, to get the sides talking. George War's better than war, as Churchill used to say. If you start people talking, it stops being a problem in the first place, so those kids never actually end up starting to commit the petty crimes and then the more serious crimes.
I mean, do you get the feeling at the end of this book that... is it a bit of a rallying cry? Do you think people will take up these solutions, or is it just kind of a neat way of saying, you know, look at how clever we were for the 30 years that I was there?
There's some, of course, there's some. And why shouldn't he? You know, lots of these ideas are very good, and I think he's right to be proud of them, and all the people involved in the book are right to be proud of them. And yeah, I do hope so, actually. It's, again, a lot of the solutions are very easy. Not a lot of money's involved. And Colgan goes back and takes some historical examples from World War II. There was a problem with a lot of US parachutes, paratroopers were. The parachutes just weren't working. Some of the paratroopers were being killed because of faulty parachutes or being injured. And then the solution was they made the packers and the inspectors of the parachutes, they were ordered to jump regularly with their own parachutes chosen at random.
Oh, my God.
That basically was a very simple way of making sure that the packers and the inspectors did a better job in the first place. And it worked. Absolutely cured the problem.
Fascinating. Why Did the Policeman Cross the Road? How to Solve Problems Before They Arise by Stephen Colgan is out now, published by Unbound. That brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks very much to my guest, Mark Mason. You've been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. This show was produced by Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow when we'll be looking ahead to the weekend in film. But for now, it's goodbye from me, and thanks very much for tuning in.